I'm Derek Russell.
And I'm Brad Locke, and this is The Memo.
A gathering of all things Northeast Mississippi, brought to you by The Daily Journal and DJournal.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome into a new episode of The Memo for this Wednesday, the 3rd of May, 2017, the year of our Lord.
Indeed.
I'm Brad Locke with Chris Kiefer there. Derek Russell's chair is empty.
Yep.
I don't know where he is. He just disappeared. He's gone.
Said he had work to do or something. I don't know.
Work, schmirk. This is work.
We'll see. Yeah.
Obviously. This is the hardest work I do all week.
Wow. That's relative.
If that were the case, I should be fired. Thanks for joining us here on this Wednesday, our newsier podcast. Of course, coming to you every Wednesday and Friday. Friday tends to be more focused on entertainment and food and that sort of thing. You can find us on iTunes and your podcast apps or at memo.djournal.com as well. We're on Twitter at djournalmemo. So, how's it going?
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
You doing all right?
Hey, no, not bad. I was here Tuesday night for election stuff, as were you.
Yeah.
And then we were both back in here way too early, in my opinion, here on this Wednesday as we talk.
Yeah, elections.
Such is life.
Elections are always long days in the newspaper business.
But on the plus side, we always get election night pizza.
There you go.
By the time I got here, it was lukewarm, but it was still election night pizza.
I didn't have any. So, I ate beforehand.
Smart. There.
You had a... Drew's baseball last night, too? How's that going?
I was late getting in here because Drew's baseball team still looking for their first win. We almost got it. We were down 6-0, heading to the final inning. We finally started hitting the ball, lost 6-5, left the tie and run on third. Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Mm. We got better, though.
That's it?
We're getting better. That's all you can ask. Your Giants are doing well, at least against the Dodgers.
No.
They beat them last night, didn't they?
No.
Was it the Dodgers that won? Because
yeah.
I could have sworn the Giants won last
night. Like 13-5.
Okay.
Don't bring it up.
Sorry. It was the night before the Giants won.
The Giants did win the night before.
Okay.
After having the worst record in the National League in April. For a day, they were tied for the best record in May. But no, they're back to their old ways. They were up 4-0 yesterday and then lost 13-5. It was bad.
Well, it's probably too early to look at the standings too much. You look at the NL Central and the Cubs are, I thought they'd be running away with it by this point, but I think all the teams are separated by like 3 games or something ridiculous. Giving me false hope for my Cardinals, maybe. The Cubs are going to be fine, I think, in the long run.
I think they are in the long run, but I do think it's hard the year after you win a title. Repeating is so hard, in part just because the off season is so short.
Sure is.
Your season goes longer, then there's all the parties and the late night TV shows and everything. By the time you kind of start getting to rest, it's time to start a new year. So.
Well, listen, it's the Cubs. They won the World Series finally. Whatever happens, if they don't win it this year, big whoop. They can ride last year's title for a while.
For 107 years.
Although with the nucleus they have, they probably want to go ahead and try to win as much as they can now while these guys are still young.
Yeah.
There's your baseball talk for the day. Mm. Hope we didn't lose anybody there.
What do we have on the show today?
What do we have? Well, we mentioned election night Tuesday. We had municipal primary elections, which for some candidates meant if they won that then they got elected to office because not everybody had opposition party candidates. For instance, Tupelo's mayor's race was between Jason Shelton and Candace Knowles in the Democratic primary. There was no Republican candidate. There was for about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Back a couple months ago.
Right.
He dropped out. So Shelton won the primary. That means he does not, general election. He has no opposition. He is going to be mayor again of Tupelo. So you had a lot of those situations.
You've got a lot of, especially smaller municipalities where everybody runs as the same party.
Right. Which saves
costs of
exactly,
having multiple elections.
That's kind of a strategy you see there in a lot of smaller towns. So.
Yeah. And it's also Mississippi's election laws. Is messed up in that, and I'm guessing Caleb may talk about this in a little bit, but the fact that you've got to decide which primary to vote in, and you can only vote in one, so like you had a case in Tupelo Ward 2,
yeah.
Where you had the Republican primary was going to decide the city council seat, the Democratic primary was going to decide the mayor, so you couldn't vote for both. You either had to vote for mayor or city council,
and
which
a lot
is
of
crazy.
Local Republicans like Shelton. He's got a lot of bipartisan support, but if they vote for that council seat, they can't vote
right.
Mayor.
You see that in state elections a lot, too. It's like you've got to decide, I want to vote you know, the Republican primary is probably going to decide who the next governor is a lot of times, but maybe I want to vote for my legislator on the Democratic side or whatever. It's
I kind of like the Louisiana system.
Yeah,
it's kind of open to you do whatever. But Caleb Bedillion and William Moore will both be in here to break it down there. For us, all the municipal election results from Tuesday, we've got Emma Kent coming on to talk about technology in local schools as it relates to state testing, kids taking tests online. Pretty much everybody's doing that nowadays. And we've also got Bobby Harrison, our Capitol Bureau Chief, going to talk with us a little bit. We've got that special session coming up next month to try to pass some budgets for certain agencies, including the Department of Transportation. So Bobby will speak with us about how that might go. So got all that coming up here on this episode of The Memo. Let's get started, I guess. So let's talk about these municipal elections we had on Tuesday. Tupelo, throughout Lee County, and other parts of Northeast Mississippi. Again, we've got Caleb Bedillion and William Moore here to talk about it. Let's start with Tupelo, Caleb. No really big surprise there with Jason Shelton winning re-election. He garnered about 85% of the vote.
That's right, about 85% of the vote of the city's 13 precincts. He outright won 12 of them, and the one he lost, he only lost by 4 votes. So pretty commanding victory. He was throwing out the word mandate in some of his comments to me on Tuesday night. So I believe he has a mandate to keep moving forward and that the voters want to see more of what he's been doing over the last 4 years.
Yeah, and you know, he ran on a platform of just economic success and I guess basically crisis management, because I mean you look at his first 4 years and he had to deal with some really heavy stuff. Of course, he had the shooting of the police officers, he had the tornado. I mean, those two things alone, that's a lot to have to handle. And then not to mention the Ronnie Shumper situation.
That's right. Mayor Jason Shelton and the incumbent city council members who are seeking re-election have all basically run more or less on a package. And they haven't explicitly put it that way, but they all basically come back around to these last 4 years have been really successful. We all work together. Let's put the whole team back in place. We got to keep everyone together. Again, no one has put it that explicitly, but it's fairly implicit in their comments, especially given the extent to which they've all emphasized how well the current council and mayor all work together.
It's a package deal, and just don't break up the package.
Exactly. If you take one piece out, that changes the dynamics. So that has kind of, below the surface, has been the way they've all kind of managed their campaigns. But yeah, Jason Shelton specifically had a primary opponent, and she didn't explicitly bill herself as a protest candidate. She didn't ever in her campaign materials talk about the Ronnie Shumper controversy, for example, but she was involved in protests last year that were unhappy about the way Shelton's administration managed that controversy. Her campaign was fairly limited. She didn't have a lot of public events or rallies. She attended one candidate's forum last week. Very little media outreach. It was a grassroots, I think, social media-driven campaign, but I don't think there was a lot of infrastructure there behind the race. Raised very little money.
Yeah.
So I certainly, if you look at some of these precincts, she only drew in, for example, one of the Ward 1 precincts, 4 votes. 9 votes in a Ward 6 precinct. Of course, those are, oddly enough, Republican-heavy precincts, which is where Shelton just, like, overwhelmingly dominated.
Right.
Of course, there is no Republican opponent, so the Democratic primary for mayor was it. That was the entire game.
Right. And you mentioned about the keeping the team together and the way they've worked together, and you can probably speak to this, William. You've worked around here for years. It's not always been the case that the mayor and all the council members together just got along swimmingly.
It hadn't always been a team. A lot of times you would have a very divided council, and, I mean, you'd see votes similar. I mean, I can remember years ago, I mean, there were almost anything that came up, there'd be a 6-3 vote. I mean, you would know exactly who the 3 were and who the 6 were. And, you know, here the last 5 or 6 years, things have gotten a little better, and folks, the mayor and the council have worked better together sort of, you know, trying to move the city forward.
Right, right. And you know, they've all been quick to say, we don't always agree. You know, I've been on the city beat about a year and a half now, and I've seen a number of 5-1 decisions, 5-2 decisions. But even when there's a divided vote, there's not a whole lot of rancor. The closest we got to that was on the state flag issue when the council had to decide whether to keep flying the state flag on city property or not. And, you know, I'm not going to say those talks were, you know, all rainbows and smiles, but it didn't get as bad as it could have gotten. You know, oddly enough, when I met with Mayor Shelton to talk about his reelection bid, he acknowledged, when I kind of asked him if there's anything he would have done differently, that things didn't necessarily get off on a tremendous foot at the beginning of his term. And when you think about collegiality, he says he was probably a little bit more confrontational that he should have been on the issue of the city attorney. If you listeners recall, Shelton pushed to hire an in-house city attorney. The council was initially somewhat skeptical, and for a while it looked like there might be enough votes to kill that idea. Compromise was eventually worked out, but Shelton told me he thinks he was more publicly aggressive on that issue and confrontational. So, you know.
Right, right. Well, you know, young mayor, first term, and I'm sure he's learned some things and kind of has a better idea of how to approach things and work with the council members.
Yeah, he started off there. You know, he came in as a defense attorney.
Right.
I mean, and he was confrontational. It was, you know, he was going, you know, argue and try to win his case instead of, you know, he's not used to, well, before when he was a defense attorney, he wasn't used to having to compromise as much, you know.
Right, right, right. We still have contested council races in the general election. So, you know, the team isn't guaranteed to go back in together. We'll have contested races in wards 3, 4, 5, and 6. So all those races feature an incumbent and a challenger. We didn't have any incumbents stepping away this election cycle. So we've got 3 incumbents for sure going back in, 2 that face no opposition, 1 ward 2 incumbent Lynn Bryan, 1 a Republican primary on Tuesday. So 3 incumbents for sure going back in, an incumbent mayor going back in, 4 incumbents that still have to face a general election.
Yeah, and one of those is Nettie Davis. She's been on the council a while in Ward 4. She fended off a couple of primary opponents, and now she faces Henry Daniels in the June 6th
That's right.
General election.
Nettie Davis was the only incumbent that had to deal with a primary fight and a general election fight. So she had 2 Democratic opponents yesterday. Theoretically, that was the race that could have gone to a runoff because you had more than 2 candidates. So that mathematically it becomes possible for no one to get a majority. But she did. She got about 60%, a little bit over that, I think. And so she goes straight to the general election where, as you say, she has to deal with Republican opponent Henry Daniels.
All right. I want to talk a little bit about maybe some other races around here. We'll start in Lee County, I guess, William.
We're going pretty much stick with Lee County this morning.
Right. Yeah, we're still trying to get results from all over there. I mean, there's a lot of little towns
and
around
some
here.
Of the ones in Lee County, we won't have official results until Wednesday afternoon.
Right, right.
But, I mean, we'll start off on, you know, the north end of the county in Baldwin. Basically, all the incumbents won.
Yeah.
And the incumbent mayor, police chief, and all 5 aldermen.
That was one of the towns where everybody ran in the same ticket.
It's one where, I mean, everybody ran as Democrats.
Yeah.
I mean, and there were some races where there were, you know, multiple candidates. I mean, there were 5 people running for police chief, and Troy Agnew, who's had the job for more than 20 years, folks resoundingly said, we want to keep Troy.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
Next one down, in Saltillo. I mean, there was... Folks were expecting a heated race for mayor because you had the incumbent Rex Smith, been there for 4 years, and a Republican challenger, Richard Herring, who had the support of former governor Haley Barbour, who was doing television ads. But that race, you know, that race never really came to be because, you know, the incumbent Rex Smith won 63.5% of the vote. And won re-election easily.
Yeah, and we had this kind of a theme throughout Lee County was a mayor's winning re-election.
There was a lot of folks pretty well happy with the status quo.
Right.
Here, but again, not ever all the folks were happy with their aldermen because, there in South Hill, three incumbents, were reelected, while a couple of others were kicked out. Malcolm Driscoll got reelected. Kopi Grantham and Craig Sanders were elected as new council or new aldermen in South Hill. Down in Nettleton, there was a similar situation where folks liked what the mayor was doing, but wanted a little bit of change there. And they're on the board of aldermen. Only one of the Nettleton aldermen will be back.
And they've got a runoff there in one of the.
They got a runoff in Ward 2 where former Nettleton boys basketball coach Jeff Finch is running against incumbent G.C. Rudy. They'll have a runoff here in 2 weeks. And then they're also in the runoff, current assistant police chief Joseph Beasley and Monroe County Deputy Sheriff Gary Monaghan are going to be in a runoff for the police chief race. They're going to see who replaces A.D. Hurd, who decided to retire this year.
And you had a nice story on him the other day, Monday.
Yeah, I mean, almost 50 years in law enforcement.
Wow.
And he decided it was time to call it quits, and he had enough.
One thing, double check. I wanted to check, William. One of the mayors, Mitch, all the mayor incumbents winning, one of them still has to go to a general election. Is that right? Was that Baldwin?
Yeah, the Baldwin incumbent mayor, Michael James. I mean, he defeated his Democratic challenger, Rosalind Copeland, 577 votes to 483. Now that race will move to the general election where he'll face independent challenger Jane Thompson. Shannon is the one that's still up in the air because there were still there were four candidates. There's three Democrats and one Republican, so there will have to be a general election. The three Democrats all met in Tuesday's election. The incumbent, Ronnie Hallmark, got 50% of the vote. And in order to win a primary, you have to have, outright, you have to have 50% plus one.
He didn't get the plus one?
He did not get the plus one. And so that will have to be decided Wednesday evening when the Democratic Executive Committee meets to count affidavit ballots to see if he can get one more vote.
Now, if they reject all the affidavits or the affidavits maintain the balance,
there will have to be a runoff, basically will cost the city about $3,000 just to have a runoff election. Mm-hmm. So,
also looking at higher election costs because they have to have a general election, which Shannon typically does not do because in the past it's all been Democrats.
In the past it's always been Democrats, but there are two Republican candidates, one for mayor and one for Ward 3 alderman.
So Shannon theoretically could have a primary runoff,
and a general election. And then, going back to the theory or the idea, that folks are, sort of unhappy with their incumbents on the Board of Aldermen races, that was the case there in Shannon as well, because, looking at the unofficial results, in Ward 2, Debbie Johnson unseated the incumbent, Joey McCord, and then in Ward 3, Lucy Blair defeated incumbent James Oswald. But, of course, Lucy Blair still has a Republican challenger in the June general election.
Yeah. And all these primary runoffs will be May 16th, by the way, so it's 2 weeks from now.
Right. And then the general election will be June 6th.
Right. Okay, well, good stuff, guys. Appreciate y'all, Caleb and William. And y'all can find the stories and the results in the Wednesday Daily Journal and also at djournal.com. Thanks, fellas.
You're welcome.
And be sure to look for the two sports podcasts we produce here at the Daily Journal. Prep Rally is a high school sports podcast with myself, Blake Morgan, and Gene Phelps. New episodes air every Wednesday, and you can listen to it for free in iTunes, your podcast apps, or at preprally.djournal.com. And for Ole Miss and Mississippi State fans, check out the Double Coverage podcast. Ole Miss beat reporter Parrish Alford and MSU reporter Logan Lowry release a new episode each Thursday or Friday, depending on how their week is going. They provide game previews, insight commentary, and analysis on the Bulldogs and the Rebels. Listen to it for free in iTunes, your podcast apps, or at doublecoverage.djournal.com.
and you can wake up and get ready for your day with the Daily Journal's News Break, a quick summary of news, sports, weather, and everything else Northeast Mississippi in a five-minute video. Shows are posted every Monday through Friday at 7 a.m. You can watch them free at any time at djournal.com, Facebook, YouTube, or the Daily Journal's mobile apps for Apple and Android devices. Stay informed on the latest happenings in your community in an easily digestible format.
Go down to Jackson now and welcome in Bobby Harrison, our Capitol Bureau Chief. How you doing, Bobby?
All right, Brad. How you doing?
Not too bad, sir. I want to catch people up on the special session that's been called by Governor Phil Bryant. It's going to start June the 5th. Last as long as they need it to. Of course, they need to get stuff figured out before the fiscal year begins July 1st. And, Bobby, we know the main reason they're trying to get some budgets worked out for Mississippi Department of Transportation, the state aid program, and the Attorney General's office. That'll be the first order of business, but we could see some other things crop up, couldn't we, Bobby?
Yeah, only the governor knows for sure, Brad. we know that those three budget bills have to be passed before July 1st, or those agencies you mentioned won't have any money, and then we'll sort of go into uncharted territory. But there, you know, there's speculation and talk that other things may be on the agenda. You know, Bill Stone, the senator from Holly Springs, who is the Senate Democrat leader, you know, he mentioned the other day he'd like to see bond bills be included. You know, there was no bond bill during the 2017 regular session. You know, bonds, state uses bonds to finance long-term construction projects, and traditionally they do a bond package every year, but they got caught up in a disagreement this year, so there's no bond package. Bill Stone would like to see that. Lieutenant Governor Tate Reeves says he doesn't want to see bonds be considered during the special session. There's speculation that everything is, a lottery, just all sorts of stuff. But only the governor has the constitutional authority to decide those issues of what will be considered in a special session. So we just have to wait and see what he does.
Bobby, it's probably one of those sessions that you wouldn't expect to take very long. I mean, I think you mentioned before it could take a day or two, we've had others go longer, but it seems like this one would probably be on the shorter side of things, wouldn't it?
Well, unless, extra items are added to the special session, if the governor put rewriting the education funding formula, to divvy money out to local school districts in the special session call, that's been an issue that Lieutenant Governor Tate Reeves and House Speaker Philip Gunn said they want to take up at some point in time. But if that was on the special session agenda, it could take, a lot longer. But, as I said, we just don't know. But if it's just the three budget bills, I would not expect it to take more than a day or two.
Yeah. You mentioned the lottery, and there's been a lot of talk about it with Governor Bryant being more open to it, and even Philip Gunn, the Speaker of the House, has been open to talking about it, at least. You had a column in today's journal actually kind of talking about that and also talking about casinos and the revenue and from there and funding education. And, you do make the point that at the end of the day, you could get some money from the lottery like you do from casinos, but ultimately it's not going to be a major chunk, is it?
Right. What was it? I've gone blank. What was the amount? It's projected that the casinos are bringing about $135 million for this budget year.
Yeah, that's right.
Put that in perspective, Brad. We've done a lot of tax cuts. The tax cut that was passed in, the big one in 2016.
Yeah.
That's going to eventually take $415 million in today's dollars out of the general fund. So,
yeah.
The casinos helped contribute to the state's revenue, but it's really, it's less than 3% of the total. So it's, and the lottery would be even less,
right?
By all accounts, we're talking about anywhere from, by most accounts, anywhere from broad brush between $50 million and $100 million a year, in a $6 million budget. That's, that would help, but it's not gonna, be a sort of a magic bullet to solve all the budget woes the state has right now.
Bobby, I want to just ask a quick question on that point. If this is something you can speak to, but anecdotally, you hear from other states rave about how much the lottery has impacted education, say in Louisiana and Georgia or two. I think of, for example, I guess I'm wondering, do you think those states are seeing a greater impact from the lottery than Mississippi would, or do you think its impact is being overstated?
Well, I mean, you know, I think in Georgia they fund college scholarships, or
same with Louisiana.
In Louisiana, and you know, if you had $50 million, you know, was total state aid in the, you know, the flip side of what I said a while ago, total state aid for tuition assistance in Mississippi. I don't have that number in front of me, but I want to say it's like $35 to $40 million, maybe.
Okay.
So if you had $70 million from a lottery and you directed all that to help with college tuition, you know, that would be impactful. So, I mean, I guess from that perspective, you know, if you took the money and you dedicated it to a particular issue, such as helping kids go to college, that it could have an impact. Now, you know what the governor says, that he'd like to see the money just go to the general fund, and where it would be just divvied out, you know, like other revenue is, you know, to education, to Medicaid, to public safety, and just, you know, the percentages that those agencies get of the regular general fund, they get that from the lottery revenue too. So, mm-hmm. you know, you take the money and direct it to, you know, to helping kids go to college, that, you know, the flip side of that is that would be provide a big impact. And you can make the case in a, you know, in a state like Mississippi, where we have fewer people with college degrees, and you know, economists say that's one of the things that is holding us back. I mean, that would, you know, from a policy standpoint, you could make the argument that'd be a smart move.
Well, good stuff there, Bobby, as always, and hopefully we'll get a specific agenda here pretty soon from the governor about exactly what they'll try to deal with besides these budgets we mentioned. You can find Bobby's work, of course, in the Daily Journal every day and at djournal.com. Follow him on Twitter at BobbyHarrison9. And also, if you want even more Bobby Harrison, and who doesn't? We've got the Capital View webcast every Monday afternoon. You can watch it live at djournal.com around 2 p.m. or catch the replay later in the day. Bobby will provide his commentary and analysis on all the issues being debated in Jackson. And while the 2017 legislative session is over, except for this special session, well, Bobby's going to continue to provide perspective about all the news coming out of the state capitol, including that special session. So, again, Bobby, we appreciate your time, man.
I appreciate it.
Let's welcome in education reporter Emma Kent. Hello, Emma. How are you?
Hello, Brad. I'm good.
Good.
Yeah.
Great. Hey, tis the season for testing, state testing. And that's what we want to talk about. One of the things we'll talk about. You had a story over the weekend about local schools and the state testing in regards to their technology infrastructure. A lot of this stuff is done online now. And so you got to have, you know, the technology infrastructure in place, the Wi-Fi access and all that good stuff. So long story short, it seems like maybe this year they're a lot further along in that regards. A lot of schools are.
Yeah, I think they're just more prepared. I mean, last year was the first time that they that all testing was done online. So, you know, you don't really know. They didn't really know if they could handle it. You just don't really know the first time you do something. And I know a lot of schools had you know, problems where their Wi-Fi network wasn't strong enough to have all of those kids on it at the same time testing, or they didn't have enough devices to kind of efficiently get everyone tested in a nice, compact amount of time, you know, so it doesn't drag on. So a lot of districts, you know, I heard just kind of throughout the school year, lots of districts kind of saying we made this adjustment because of testing or this or that or whatever. So I think this year things are going more smoothly, thankfully.
Yeah. And I mean, you spoke with Jimmy Weeks of Lee County School District, Tony Cook of Houston. And, you know, this is obviously a largely rural area. So internet access in itself can be a challenge for a lot of people. So how difficult has it been for them to really build up that infrastructure?
You know, it's not too difficult. It's just something you have to do over time because it is expensive.
Yeah.
And so finding the funding to do that is really the challenge. A lot of it is funded, by federal funds, Title I, and E-rate funding, which a lot of school districts use to build up their technology. So most districts that are rural like that, that have a smaller tax base and less district funds to use, do rely on outside sources for building up their technology infrastructure. And talking to Tony Cook from Houston, he was saying, you know, that's kind of a challenge in itself, relying on those funds, because we never really know, you know, that just changes. It can change from year to year. It can go away completely. It can decrease. It's just, you know, it's kind of I don't know, a gamble, I guess.
Then you know, you got the problem, and it's also kind of expensive of having enough devices, computers, mm-hmm. for people yeah. to take tests on. And that's still something that some of these school districts are trying to build up, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, some districts do have a one-to-one program where, you know, every student has a device, one device for every student, but that is really expensive to do. And so some of these districts that don't have as much in the way of funding and resources, you know, they've got to figure out how many devices do we need to make sure we can test kids in a way that's efficient, you know, that's not going to drag testing on for weeks and weeks, you know, because that just, it's not good for the students. It kind of wears on them, and it just overall, it'd be better just knock it out. So, so that's another kind of thing they've had to figure out. And it seems like they're figuring that out, and things are hopefully running smoothly now.
No, it's going to come a day when kids won't know none of the kids will know the joy of filling out those,
The Scantron
sheets, mm-hmm. those and long always,
it
rectangular.
It takes like an hour to do that too.
And I was one of those really anal retentive kids that had to make sure I get every little bit of that whole. That
you're like, they're not going to grade my test if I have one eraser
the
mark.
The whole thing is filled in.
It's all these critical skills were just taken away: cursive handwriting, filling in Scantron bubbles. What's going to happen to the future generations?
I never really enjoyed school that much, but I always loved getting those Scantron things back. I just thought they were kind of cool, and especially. I got a good grade, obviously, and it's just, you know, one of my few fond memories from school.
That is really weird, Brad.
I know. I am.
I could live
like
without
that.
The Scantrons.
I didn't really necessarily enjoy filling them out, although maybe I did because I'm weird about those kind of rote.
It would kind of freak. Did it ever freak you out? Like if you were filling it out and then you would be like, you know, you would look back at maybe the last 10 questions you answered and they were like all the same one and it was a line and you're like, something must be wrong.
They're all, I answered C on every one. Well, I'll get at least half of them right.
Probably. Yeah, that would be a strategy on the standardized test if you're running out of time.
Yeah, just answer everything C.
Yeah, where did that come from?
I don't know.
Is that a real?
Yeah, because I think the answers are evenly distributed. Mm. There's usually like 12 A's and 12 B's and 12 C's throughout
the
course of
the
test. So really,
you could choose any letter.
Yeah, and just stick with it.
And still have a chance of.
Yeah. But anyway, yes, kids will soon not be able to experience that.
I bet some kids, I bet if you ask some young elementary kids, they probably wouldn't know what you were talking about.
Probably right, yeah.
You know, they probably wouldn't know what a Scantron is, but that's okay.
Another piece of my youth becoming a relic, getting old. well, let's talk real quick about the ICC president. They announced that yesterday.
Yes.
That they've got somebody to replace Mike Eaton. Mm-hmm. And the guy has Mississippi roots. He's currently at Kentucky. Jay Allen, he's currently at a community college in Kentucky. So he's got a lot of experience in the community college system here, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm. He's been at Hines Community College and Mississippi Gulf Coast Community College, and he's currently the president at Hopkinsville Community College in Kentucky. So, he's been around the community college circuit.
Yeah,
so, you know, I guess he'll know what he's doing when he gets to ICC.
Yeah, and he's got degrees from, actually, he has a degree from Hines, an associate's degree. Then he got his bachelor and his master's from Mississippi State. And he got a doctorate, like 8 years ago from
Ole
Miss.
Yeah.
So he's also got, he seems very, very qualified.
Yes. I think that, he seems pretty qualified.
Yeah. And obviously haven't got a chance to talk to him yet. He's not been made available.
No. Yet. Well, I mean, and him not being local.
Right. He's in Kentucky.
Yeah. So he'll replace Mike Eaton, who will be done and officially retire in June. Okay. And he's been the president since 2013. Okay. So let's see, what's that, 4 years now?
Yeah. And so, this would be just the seventh president at ICC, which I found interesting.
Yeah, I did too.
They've had some long tenured people there, I guess.
So.
Yeah.
How long has ICC been around? A long time, I would assume.
Yeah.
60s? Does that sound right?
At least. Maybe earlier. I'm not sure,
because
to be honest.
It used to be affiliated, I think, with the high school there.
Maybe so.
In Awamba High School. Somehow they were all, it was the junior college and high school together, and they've separated. I don't remember the exact details.
Well, none of us were around then. But, yeah, he seems very much qualified, has a lot of experience in different aspects of administration, and I'm sure you'll get to talk to him at some point here.
Yeah,
get to know more about him.
Hopefully soon. We'll get to meet him, talk to him, and maybe we can even bring him on the podcast.
We could do that.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly.
We'll see.
So, Jay,
if you're out there.
Yeah.
If you're listening.
If you're listening in Kentucky, Jay, it's an open invitation. Come on the memo. But anyway, that story is in the Wednesday Journal. So thank you, Emma, for coming on to the show again.
Thanks, Brad.
Well, another fine episode in the books, Chris Kiefer.
Always.
Info-packed.
Stellar.
Infotainment.
That's it.
That's what I call it.
It's what we do.
We try. Anyway. We come to you again every Wednesday and Friday-ish. Today, of course, was more of a newsy episode. Friday, we'll talk about entertainment and food. I'm assuming we'll have the usual suspects, Scott Morris, Jenna Parsons, Derek should be back to talk about the local entertainment scene. So that'll be fun, as it always is. And again, you can access us a variety of ways. Of course, we're in iTunes, Google Play, any of your podcast apps like Stitcher, Player.fm, what have you. Also online, you can stream us at memo.djournal.com. So if you have one of the easiest way to do it, you can take it on the go, is to get us in iTunes or one of those podcast apps. Click the subscribe button. You'll get notified every time that a new episode drops. Or you can also follow us on Twitter to get that info when we have new episodes. It's at @djournalmemo.
That's it.
So there you go.
No excuses.
Yeah. And by the way, we'll have more election coverage. We talked about that a lot today with William and Caleb. We'll have more in the coming days online and in the journal. So be sure to look for all of that. And that's it. We're done.
See you Friday.
Yeah. Have a good one.